I've never met Keegan before. He's only the commander of the CDF Second Army, Harry said. I'm sure it's nothing important.
Funny, I said.
It's 9:15 now, John,
Jesse said.
You'd better get moving. You want us to walk with you?
No, please, finish breakfast, I said. It'll be good for me to have the walk. The Eisenhower module is only a couple of clicks around the station. I can make it in time. I got up, grabbed a donut to eat on the way, gave Jesse a friendly peck on the cheek, and headed off. In fact, the Eisenhower module was more than a couple of clicks away, but my leg had finally grown in, and I wanted the exercise. Dr. Fiorina was right. The new leg did feel better than new, and overall I felt as if I had more energy. Of course, I had just recovered from injuries so grave it was a miracle that I lived. Anyone would feel like they had more energy after that.
"Don't turn around,"
Jane said, into my ear from directly behind me. I nearly choked on a bite of donut.
"I wish you wouldn't keep sneaking up on me,"
I finally said, not turning around.
"Sorry," she said. "I'm not intentionally trying to annoy you, but I shouldn't be talking to you. Listen, this briefing you're about to go to."
"How do you know about that?"
I said.
"It doesn't matter. What matters is that you agree to what they ask of you. Do it. It's the way you're going to be safe for what's coming up, as safe as can be."
"What's coming up?" I asked.
"You'll find out soon enough," she said.
"What about my friends?" I said. "Harry and Jesse, are they in trouble?"
"We're all in trouble," Jane said. "I can't do anything for them. I worked to sell you as it is. Do this. It's important."
There was a quick touch of a hand on my arm, and then I could tell she was gone again.
"Corporal Perry,"
General Keegan said, returning my salute.
"At ease."
I had been escorted into a conference room with more brass in it than an 18th-century schooner. I was easily the lowest-ranking person in the room. The next lowest rank, as far as I could tell, was a lieutenant colonel, Newman, my esteemed questioner. I felt a little queasy.
"You look a little lost, son,"
General Keegan said to me. He looked, as did everyone in the room and every soldier in the CDF, no more than in his late 20s.
"I feel a little lost, sir," I said.
"Well, that's understandable," Keegan said. "Please, sit down."
He motioned to an empty chair at the table. I took it and sat down.
"I've heard a lot about you, Perry."
"Yes, sir," I said, trying not to glance over at Newman.
"You don't sound excited about that, Corporal," he said.
"I'm not trying to be noticed, sir," I said. "Just trying to do my part."
"Be that as it may, you have been noticed," Keegan said. 100 shuttles managed to get launched over Coral, but yours was the only one to make it to the surface, in great part due to your orders to pop the shuttle bay doors and get the hell out of there."
He jerked a thumb to Newman.
"Newman here has been telling me all about it. He thinks we should give you a medal for it."
Keegan could have said, "Newman thinks you should star in the Army's annual performance of Swan Lake," and I would not have been as surprised as I was. Keegan noticed the expression on my face and grinned.
"Yes, I know what you were thinking. Newman has the best straight face in the business, which is why he has the job he does. Well, what about it, Corporal? Think you deserve that medal?"
"Respectfully, sir, no," I said. "We crashed, and there were no survivors other than myself. It's hardly meritorious service. Beyond that, any praise in making it to the surface of Coral belongs to my pilot, Fiona Eaton."
"Pilot Eaton has already been decorated posthumously, Corporal," General Keegan said. "Small consolation to her, being dead as she is, but it's important to the CDF that such actions are noted somewhere by us. And despite your modesty, Corporal, you will be decorated as well. Others survived the Battle of Coral, but that was by luck. You took initiative and showed leadership in an adverse situation, and you've shown your capacity to think on your feet before. That firing solution against the Kansu, your leadership in your training platoon. Master Sergeant Ruiz made special note of your use of the brain pal in the final training war game. I served with that son of a bitch, Corporal. Ruiz wouldn't compliment his mother for giving birth to him, if you know what I mean.
I think I do, sir, I said.
That's what I thought. So, a bronze star for you, son. Congratulations.
Well, yes, sir, I said.
Thank you, sir.
But I didn't ask you here for that purpose, General Keegan said, and then motioned down the table.
I don't believe you've met General Szilard, who heads our special forces. At ease, no need to salute.
Sir, I said, nodding in his direction at least.
Corporal, Szilard said, tell me, what have you heard about the situation over Coral?
Not very much, sir, I said. Just conversations with friends.
Really? Szilard said dryly. I would think your friend, Private Wilson, would have given you a comprehensive briefing by now.
I was beginning to realize that my poker face, never very good, was even less so these days.
Yes, of course we know about Private Wilson, Szilard said. You might want to tell him that his snooping around is not nearly as subtle as he thinks it is.
Harry will be surprised to hear it, I said.
No doubt, Szilard said. I also have no doubt he's also appraised you on the nature of the Special Forces soldiers. It's not a state secret, incidentally, although we don't put information on the Special Forces in the general database. Most of our time is spent on missions that require strict secrecy and confidentiality. We have very few opportunities to spend much time with the rest of you. Not much inclination, either.
General Szilard and Special Forces are taking the lead on our counterattack on the array at Coral, General Keegan said. While we intend to take the planet, our immediate concern is to isolate their tachyon detection apparatus, disable it without destroying it if we can, but destroy it if we must. Colonel Golden here, Keegan motioned to a somber-looking man next to Newman, believes we know where it is. Colonel?
Very briefly, Corporal, Golden said. Our surveillance before the first attack on Coral showed the array deploying a series of small satellites in orbits around Coral. At first we thought them to be spy satellites to help the array identify colonial and troop movement on the planet, but now we think it's an array designed to spot tachyon patterns. We believe the tracking station, which compiles the data from the satellites, is on the planet itself, landed there during the first wave of the attack.
We think it's on the planet because they figure it's safest there, General Szilard said. If it were on a ship, there's a chance an attacking CDF ship might hit it, if only by sheer luck. And as you know, no ship but your shuttle got anywhere close to the coral surface. It's a good bet it's there.
I turned to Keegan. May I ask a question, sir?
Go ahead,
Keegan said. Why are you telling me this? I asked. I'm a corporal with no squad, platoon, or battalion. I can't see why I should need to know this.
Well, you need to know this because you're one of the few survivors of the Battle of Coral and the only one that survived by something more than chance, Keegan said. General Szilard and his people believe, and I agree, that their counterattack has a better chance of succeeding if someone who was there in the first attack advises and observes the second. That means you.
With all due respect, sir, I said, my participation was minimal and disastrous.
Less disastrous than almost everyone else's, Keegan said.
Corporal, I won't lie to you. I'd prefer we'd have someone else in this role. However, as it stands, we do not. Even if the amount of advice and service you can give is minimal, it is better than nothing at all. Besides, you've shown the ability to improvise and act quickly in combat situations. You will be of use.
What would I do? I asked.
Keegan glanced over to Szilard.
You'd be stationed on the Sparrowhawk, Szilard said. They represent the Special Forces with the most experience in this particular situation. Your job would be to advise the Sparrowhawk's senior staff on your experience at Coral, observe and act as liaison between CDF regular forces and Special Forces if one is required.
Would I fight? I asked.
You're a supernumerary, Szilard said. You would most likely not be required to participate in the actual engagement.
"You understand that this assignment is highly unusual," Keegan said. "As a practical matter, due to differences in mission and in personnel, regular CDF and special forces are almost never mixed. Even in battles in which the two forces are engaged against a single enemy, both tend to perform separate and mutually exclusive roles."
"I understand," I said.
I understood more than they knew. Jane was stationed on the Sparrowhawk. As if following my train of thought, Szilard spoke up.
"Corporal, I do understand that you had an incident with one of my people, one stationed on the Sparrowhawk. I need to know that there will be no other incidents like that one."
"Yes, sir," I said. "The incident was over a misunderstanding, a case of mistaken identity. It won't happen again."
Szilard nodded to Keegan.
"Very well," Keegan said. "Corporal, given your new role, I think your rank is deficit to the task. You are hereby promoted to lieutenant, effective immediately, and will present yourself to Major Crick, CO of the Sparrowhawk, at 1500. That should give you enough time to get your things in order and say your goodbyes. Any questions?"
"No, sir," I said. "But I have one request."
"Not the usual thing," Keegan said after I had finished. "And in other circumstances, in both cases, I would say no."
"I understand, sir," I said.
"However, it will be arranged, and some good might come out of it."
"Very well, Lieutenant. You're dismissed."
Harry and Jesse met me as soon as they could after I messaged them. I told them of my assignment and promotion.
"You think Jane engineered this?"
Harry said.
"I know she did," I said. "She told me she had. As it happens, I may actually turn out to be useful in some way, but I'm sure she planted a bug in someone's ear. I'm on my way in just a few hours."
"We're being broken up again," Jesse said. "And what's left of Harry's and my platoon is being split up, too. Our platoon mates are getting assignments to other ships. We're waiting to hear our own assignments."
"Who knows, John?"
Harry said.
"We'll probably be back at Coral with you."
"No, you won't," I said.
"I asked General Keegan to advance you both out of general infantry, and he agreed. Your first term of service is done. You've both been reassigned."
"What are you talking about?"
Harry said.
"You've been reassigned to CDF's military research arm," I said.
"Harry, they knew about you snooping around. I convinced them you'd do less harm to yourself and others this way. You're going to work on whatever we bring back from Coral."
"I can't do that,"
Harry said.
"I don't have the math for it."
"I'm sure you won't let that stop you," I said.
"Jesse, you're going to MR2, on the support staff. It's all I could get you on short notice. It's not going to be very interesting, but you can train for other roles while you're there, and you'll both be out of the line of fire."
"This isn't right, John," Jesse said. "We haven't served our time. Our platoon mates are going back out to fight while we'll be sitting here for something we didn't do. You're going back out there. I don't want this. I should serve my time."
Harry nodded.
"Jesse, Harry, please," I said.
"Look, Alan is dead. Susan and Thomas are dead. Maggie is dead. My squad and my platoon are all gone. Everyone I've ever cared about out here is gone but you two. I had a chance to keep you two alive, and I took it. I couldn't do anything for anyone else. I can do something for you. I need you to be alive. You're all I have out here."
"You have Jane," Jesse said.
"I don't know what Jane is to me yet," I said. "But I know what you are to me. You're my family now. Jesse, Harry, you're my family. Don't be angry with me for wanting to keep you safe. Just be safe. For me. Please."
Chapter 15
Sparrowhawk was a quiet ship. Your average troop ship is filled with the sounds of people talking, laughing, yelling, and going through the verbal motions of their lives. Special Forces soldiers don't do any of that crap. As was explained to me by the Sparrowhawk's CO when I came on board.
"Don't expect people to talk to you,"
Major Crick said as I presented myself.
"Sir?"
I said.
"The Special Forces soldiers,"
he said.
It's not anything personal, it's just we're not much for talking. When we're by ourselves, we communicate almost exclusively by BrainPal. It's faster, and we don't have a bias towards talking, like you do. We're born with BrainPals. The first time anyone ever talks to us is with one of them, so it's the way we talk most of the time. Don't be offended. Anyway, I've ordered the troops to speak to you if they have something they need to get across.
Well, that's not necessary, sir, I said.
I can use my brain pal.
You wouldn't be able to keep up,
Major Crick said. Your brain is set to communicate at one speed and ours at another. Talking to Realborn is like talking at half speed. If you've talked to any of us for a great deal of time, you might notice we seem abrupt and curt. It's a side effect of feeling like you're talking to a slow child. No offense.
None taken, sir, I said.
You seem to communicate well.
Well, as a CO, I spend a lot of time with non-special forces, Crick said. Also, I'm older than most of my troops. I've picked up a few social graces.
How old are you, sir? I asked.
I'll be 14 next week, he said. Now, I'll be having a staff meeting tomorrow at 0600. Until then, get yourself set up and comfortable. Have some chow and get a little rest. We'll talk more in the morning.
He saluted, and I was dismissed. Jane was waiting in my quarters.
You again, I said, smiling.
Me again, she said simply. I wanted to know how you're getting along.
Well, fine, I said. Considering I've been on the ship for 15 minutes.
We're all talking about you, Jane said.
Yes, I can tell by the endless chatter, I said.
Jane opened her mouth to speak, but I held up my hand.
That was a joke, I said. Major Crick told me about the brain pal thing.
It's why I like talking to you like this, Jane said. It's not like talking to anyone else.
I seem to remember you talking when you rescued me, I said.
We were worried about being tracked then, Jane said. Speaking was more secure. We also speak when we're out in public. We don't like to draw attention to ourselves when we don't have to.
Why did you arrange this? I asked her. Getting me stationed here on the Sparrowhawk.
You're useful to us, Jane said. You have experience that may be useful, both on Coral and for another element of our preparation.
What does that mean? I asked.
Major Crick will talk about it tomorrow at the briefing, Jane said. I'll be there too. I command a platoon and do intelligence work.
Is that the only reason? I asked. That I'm useful?
No, Jane said. But it's the reason that got you onto the ship. Listen, I won't be spending too much time with you. I have too many things to do preparing for our mission, but I want to know about her. About Kathy. Who she was, what she was like. I want you to tell me.
I'll tell you about her, I said. On one condition.
What?
Jane asked. You have to tell me about you, I said.
Why?
Because for 9 years I've been living with the fact my wife is dead and now you're here and it's messing me up inside, I said. The more I know about you, the more I can get used to the idea that you're not her.
I'm not that interesting, Jane said, and I'm only 6. That's hardly any time to have done anything.
I've done more things in the last year than I did in all the years leading up to it, I said. Trust me, 6 years is enough.
Sir, one company?
The nice young, probably 4-year-old, Special Forces soldier said as he and 4 of his buddies held their meal trays at attention.
Oh, the table's empty, I said.
Some people prefer to eat alone, the soldier said.
I'm not one of them, I said.
Please, sit, all of you.
Thank you, sir,
the soldier said, putting his tray on the table.
I'm Corporal Sam Mendel. These are Privates George Linnaeus, Will Hagel, Jim Bohr, and Jan Fermi.
Lieutenant John Perry, I said.
So, what do you think of the Sparrowhawk, sir? Mendel asked.
It's nice and quiet, I said.
That it is, sir, Mendel said. I was just mentioning to Linnaeus that I don't think I've spoken more than 10 words in about a month.
You've just broken your record, then, I said.
Would you mind settling a bet for us, sir? Mendel said.
Does it involve me doing anything strenuous? I asked.
No, sir, Mendel said. We just want to know how old you are. You see, Hagel here is betting your age is older than 2x the combined ages of our entire squad.
How old are you all? I asked.
The squad has 10 soldiers in it, including myself, Mendel said. And I'm the oldest. I'm 5 and a half. The rest are between 2 and 5 years old. Total age is 37 years and about 2 months.
Well, I'm 76, I said. So he's right. Although any CDF recruit would have let him win his bet, we don't even enlist until we're 75, and let me just say, there's something profoundly disturbing about being twice as old as your entire squad, combined.
Yes, sir, Mendel said. But on the other hand, we've all been in this life at least twice as long as you, so it comes out about even.
I suppose it does at that, I said.
It must be interesting, sir, Bohr said, a little down the table. You had an entire life before this one. What was it like?
What was what like? I said. My life, or just having a life before this one?
Either, Bohr said.
I suddenly realized that none of the 5 other members of the table had even picked up their forks to eat. The rest of the mess hall, which had been alive with the telegraph tapping sounds of utensils hitting trays, had also gone largely quiet. I recalled Jane's comment about everyone being interested in me.
Apparently she was right. I liked my life, I said. I don't know that it was exciting or even interesting to anyone who didn't live it, but for me it was a good life. As for the idea of having a life before this one, I didn't really think about it at the time. I never really thought about what this life would be like before I was in it.
Why did you choose it, then? Bohr asked. You had to have some idea what it was like.
No, I didn't, I said. I don't think any of us did. Most of us had never been in a war or in the military. None of us knew that they would take who we were and put it into a new body that was only partially what we were before.
Well, that seems kind of stupid, sir, Bohr said,
and I was reminded that being 2 or whatever age he was not conducive to tact.
I don't know why anyone would choose to sign up for something when he really had no idea what he was getting into.
Well, I said, you've also never been old. An unmodified person at 75 is a lot more willing to take a leap of faith than you might be.
How different can it be? Bohr asked.
"Spoken like a 2-year-old who will never age," I said.
"I'm 3," Bohr said,
a little defensively. I held up my hand.
"Look," I said, "let's turn this around for a minute. I'm 76, and I did make a leap of faith when I joined the CDF. On the other hand, it was my choice. I didn't have to go. If you have a hard time imagining what it must be like for me, think about it on my end." I pointed to Mendel. "When I was 5, I hardly knew how to tie my own shoes. If you can't imagine what it's like to be my age and joining up, imagine how hard it is for me to imagine being an adult at 5 years of age and knowing nothing but war. If nothing else, I have an idea of what life is like outside the CDF. What is it like for you?"
Mendel looked at his companions, who looked back at him.
"It's not anything we usually think about, sir," Mendel said. "We don't know that there's anything unusual about it at first. Everyone we know was born the same way. It's you who are the unusual ones from our perspective. Having a childhood and living an entire other life before you get into this one, it just seems like an inefficient way to do things."
"Don't you ever wonder about what it would be like not to be in the Special Forces?" I asked.
"I can imagine it," Bohr said,
and the others nodded.
"We're all soldiers together. It's what we do. It's who we are."
"That's why we find you so interesting," Mendel said. "This idea that this life would be a choice, the idea that there's another way to live, it's alien."
"What did you do, sir?" asked Bohr. "In your other life?"
"I was a writer," I said.
They all looked at each other.
"What?" I asked.
"A strange way to live, sir," Mendel said. "To get paid for stringing words together?"
"There were worse jobs," I said.
"We don't mean to offend you, sir," Bohr said.
"I'm not offended," I said. "You just have a different perspective on things. But it does make me wonder why you do it."
"Do what?"
Bohr said.
"Fight," I said.
"You know, most people in the CDF are like me.
and most people in the colonies are even more different from you than I am, why would you fight for them, and with us? We're human, sir, Mendel said. No less than you are.
Well, given the current state of my DNA, that's not saying much, I said.
You know you're human, sir, Mendel said, and so do we. You and we are closer than you think. We know about how the CDF picks its recruits. You're fighting for colonists you've never met, colonists who were your country's enemy at one point. Why do you fight for them?
Because they're human and because I said I would, I said. At least, that's why I did at the start. Now I don't fight for the colonists. I mean, I do, but when it comes down to it, I fight, or did fight, for my platoon and my squad. I looked out for them, and they looked out for me. I fought because doing any less would have been letting them down.
Mendel nodded. That's why we fight too, sir, he said. So that's one thing makes us all human together. That's good to know.
It is, I agreed.
Mendel grinned and picked up his fork to eat, and as he did, the room came alive with the clattering utensils. I looked up at the noise and, from a far corner, saw Jane staring back at me. Major Crick got right to the point at the morning briefing.
CDF Intelligence believes the RA are frauds, he said, and the first part of our mission is to find out if they're right. We're going to be paying a little visit to the Khonsu. That woke me right up. Apparently I wasn't the only one.
What the hell do the Khonsu have to do with any of this? Asked Lieutenant Tagore, who sat directly to my left. Crick nodded to Jane, who was sitting near him.
At the request of Major Crick and others, I did some research into some of the other CDF encounters with the RA to see if there's been any indication of technological evolution, Jane said. Over the last 100 years, we've had 12 significant military encounters with the RA, and several dozen smaller engagements, including one major encounter and 6 smaller engagements over the last 5 years. During this entire time, the RA technological curve has been substantially behind our own. This is due to a number of factors, including their own cultural biases against systematic technological advancement and their lack of positive engagement with more technologically advanced races.
In other words, they're backwards and bigoted, Major Crick said.
In the case of skip drive technology, this is especially the case, Jane said. Up until the Battle of Coral, RA skip technology was far behind ours. In fact, their current understanding of skip physics is directly based on information provided by the CDF a little over a century ago, during an aborted trade mission to the RA.
Why was it aborted? Asked Captain Jung from across the table.
The RA ate about a third of the trade delegates, Jane said.
Ouch, said Captain Jung. The point here is that given who the RA are and what their level of tech is, it's impossible that they could have gone from being so far behind us to so far ahead of us in one leap, Major Crick said. The best guess is that they didn't. They simply got the tech for skip-drive prediction from some other culture. We know everyone the RA know, and there's only one culture that we estimate has the technological ability for something like this.
The Khonsu, said Tagore.
The Khonsu indeed, agreed Crick. Those bastards have a white dwarf yoked to the wheel. It's not unreasonable to assume they might have skip-drive prediction licked as well.
But why would they have anything to do with the RA? Asked Lieutenant Dalton, down near the end of the table. The only time they deal with us is when they want a little exercise, and we're far more technologically advanced than the RA are.
The thinking is that the Khonsu aren't motivated by technology like we are, Jane said. Our tech is valueless to them much in the same way the secrets of a steam engine might be valueless to us. We think they're motivated by other factors.
Religion, I said.
All eyes shifted to me, and I suddenly felt like the choir boy who has just farted during a chapel service.
What I mean is, when my platoon was fighting the Khonsu, they started with a prayer that consecrated the battle. I said to a friend at the time that I thought the Khonsu thought they were baptizing the planet with the battle.
more stares.
"Of course, I could be wrong."
"You're not wrong,"
Crick said.
"There's been some debate in the CDF about why the Khonsu fight at all, since it's clear that with their technology they could wipe out every other space-faring culture in the region without much of a second thought. The prevailing thought is that they do it for entertainment, like we play baseball or football."
"We never play football or baseball," said Tagore.
"Other humans do, jackass,"
Crick said with a grin, then sobered up again.
"However, a significant minority of CDF's intelligence division believes that their battles have ritual significance, just as Lieutenant Perry has suggested. The RA may not be able to trade tech with the Khonsu on an equal basis, but they might have something else the Khonsu want. They might be able to give them their souls."
"But the RA are zealots themselves," Dalton said. "That's why they attacked Coral in the first place."
"They have several colonies, some less desirable than others," Jane said. "Zealots or not, they might see trading one of their less successful colonies for Coral as a good trade."
"Not so good for the RA on the traded colony," Dalton said.
"Really? Ask me if I care about them," Crick said.
"The Khonsu have given the RA technology that puts them far ahead of the rest of the cultures in this part of space,"
Jung said.
"Even for the mighty Khonsu, tipping the balance of power in the region has to have repercussions."
"Unless the Khonsu shortchanged the RA," I said.
"What do you mean?" Jung said.
"Well, we're assuming that the Khonsu gave the RA the technological expertise to create the skip-drive detection system," I said. "But it's possible that they simply gave a single machine to the RA, with an owner's manual or something like that, so they could operate it. That way the RA get what they want, which is a way to defend Coral from us, while the Khonsu avoid substantially disrupting the balance of power in the area."
"Until the RA figure out how the damn thing works,"
Jung said.
"Given their native state of technology, that could take years," I said. "Enough time for us to kick their ass and take that technology away from them. If the Khonsu did actually give them the technology. If the Khonsu only gave them a single machine. If the Khonsu actually give a shit about the balance of power in the region. Yeah, a lot of ifs."
"And it is to find out the answer to those ifs that we're going to drop in on the Khonsu,"
Crick said.
"We've already sent a skip drone to let them know we're coming. We'll see what we can get out of them."
"What colony are we going to offer them?" Dalton asked.
It was difficult to tell if he was joking.
"No colonies," Crick said. "But we have something that might induce them to give us an audience."
"What do we have?" Dalton asked.
"We have him,"
Crick said, and pointed at me.
"Him?"
Dalton said.
"Me," I said.
"You," Jane said.
"I'm suddenly confused and terrified," I said.
"Your two-shot firing solution allowed CDF forces to rapidly kill thousands of Khonsu," Jane said. "In the past, the Khonsu have been receptive to embassies from the colonies when they have included a CDF soldier who has killed a large number of Khonsu in battle. Since it was your firing solution specifically that allowed the quick end of those Khonsu fighters, their deaths accrue to you."
"You've got the blood of 8,433 Khonsu on your hands,"
Crick said.
"Great," I said.
"It is great,"
Crick said.
"Your presence is going to get us in the door." "What's going to happen to me after we get through the door?" I asked. "Imagine what we would do to a Khonsu who'd killed 8,000 of us."
"They don't think the same way we do about that," Jane said. "You should be safe."
"Should be," I said.
"The alternative is being blasted out of the sky when we show up in Khonsu space," Crick said.
"I understand," I said. "I just wish I'd been given a little more lead time to get used to the idea."
"It was a rapidly evolving situation," Jane said nonchalantly. And suddenly I got Brain Pal message. "Trust me," it said.
I looked back at Jane, who was looking placidly at me. I nodded, acknowledging one message while appearing to acknowledge the other.
"What do we do after they're done admiring Lieutenant Perry?"
asked Tagore.
If everything goes according to past encounters, we'll have the opportunity to ask up to 5 questions of the Khonsu, Jane said. The actual number of questions will be determined by a contest involving combat between 5 of us and 5 of them. The combat is one-on-one. The Khonsu fight unarmed, but our fighters will be allowed knives to compensate for our lack of slashing arms. The one thing to be especially aware of is that in previous cases where we've had this ritual, the Khonsu we've fought were disgraced soldiers or criminals for whom this battle can restore honor. So, needless to say, they're very determined. We get to ask as many questions as the number of contests we win.
How do you win the contest? Tagore asked.
You kill the Khonsu, or it kills you, Jane said.
Fascinating, Tagore said.
One other detail, Jane said. The Khonsu pick the combatants from those we bring with us, so protocol requires at least 3 times the number of selectable combatants. The only exempted member of the delegation is its leader, who is, by courtesy, the one human assumed to be above fighting with Khonsu criminals and failures.
Perry, you get to be leader of the delegation, Crick said. Since you're the one who killed 8,000 of the buggers, by their lights you'd be the natural leader. Also, you're the sole non-special forces soldier here, and you lack certain speed and strength modifications the rest of us have. If you were to get picked, you might actually get killed.
I'm touched you care, I said.
It's not that, Crick said. If our star attraction was killed by a lowly criminal, it could jeopardize the chances of getting the Khonsu to cooperate.
Okay,
I said. For a second there, I thought you were going soft. No chance of that, Crick said. Now then, we have 43 hours until we reach skip distance. There will be 40 of us in the delegation, including all platoon and squad leaders. I'll choose the rest from the ranks. That means that each of you will drill your soldiers in hand-to-hand combat between now and then. Perry, I've downloaded the delegation protocols to you. Study them and don't screw up. Just after we skip, you and I will meet so I can give you the questions we want to ask in the order we want to ask them. If we're good, we'll have 5 questions, but we have to be ready if we need to ask fewer. Let's get to it, people. You're dismissed.
During those 43 hours, Jane learned about Kathy. Jane would pop into where I was, ask, listen, and disappear, off to tend to her duties. It was a strange way to share a life.
Tell me about her, she asked,
as I studied the protocol information in a forward lounge.
I met her when she was in the first grade, I said,
and then had to explain what first grade was. Then I told her the first memory I had of her, which was of sharing paste for a construction paper project during the art period the first and second grades shared. How she caught me eating a little of the paste and told me I was gross. How I hit her for saying that, and she decked me in the eye. She got suspended for a day. We didn't speak again until junior high.
How old are you in the first grade?
She asked.
6 years old, I said. As old as you are now.
Tell me about her,
she asked again, a few hours later in a different place.
Kathy almost divorced me once, I said. We had been married for 10 years, and I had an affair with another woman. When Kathy found out, she was furious.
Why would she care that you had sex with someone else? Jane asked.
Well, it wasn't really about the sex, I said. It was that I lied to her about it. Having sex with someone else only counted as a hormonal weakness in her book. Lying counted as disrespect, and she didn't want to be married to someone who had no respect for her.
Why didn't you divorce? Jane asked.
Because, despite the affair, I loved her and she loved me, I said. We worked it out because we wanted to be together. And anyway, she had an affair a few years later, so I guess you could say we evened up. We actually got along better after that.
Tell me about her,
Jane asked, later. Kathy made pies like you wouldn't believe, I told her. She had this recipe for strawberry rhubarb pie that would knock you on your ass. There was one year where Kathy entered her pie in a state fair contest, and the governor of Ohio was the judge. First prize was a new oven from Sears.
Did she win?
Jane asked. No. She got second, which was a $100 gift certificate to a bed and bath store. But about a week later, she got a phone call from the governor's office. His aide explained to Kathy that for political reasons he gave the first place award to the wife of an important contributor's best friend, but that ever since the governor had a slice of her pie, he couldn't stop talking about how great it was. So would she please bake another pie for him so he would shut up about the damn pie for once?
Tell me about her, Jane asked.
Well, the first time I knew I was in love with her was my junior year in high school, I said. Our school was doing a performance of Romeo and Juliet, and she was selected as Juliet. I was the play's assistant director, which most of the time meant I was building sets or getting coffee for Mrs. Amos, the teacher who was directing. But when Kathy started having a little trouble with her lines, Mrs. Amos assigned me to go over them with her. So for 2 weeks after rehearsals, Kathy and I would go over to her house and work on her lines, although mostly we just talked about other things like teenagers do. It was all very innocent at the time. Then the play went into dress rehearsal, and I heard Kathy speaking all those lines to Jeff Green, who was playing Romeo. And I got jealous. She was supposed to be speaking those words to me.
What did you do?
Jane asked. I moped around through the entire run of the play, which was 4 performances between Friday night and Sunday afternoon, and avoided Kathy as much as possible. Then at the cast party on Sunday night, Judy Jones, who had played Juliet's nurse, found me and told me that Kathy was sitting on the cafeteria loading dock, crying her eyes out. She thought I hated her because I'd been ignoring her for the last 4 days, and she didn't know why. Judy then added, if I didn't go out there and tell her I was in love with her, she'd find a shovel and beat me to death with it.
How did she know you were in love?
Jane asked. When you're a teenager and you're in love, it's obvious to everyone but you and the person you're in love with, I said. Don't ask me why. It just works that way. So I went out to the loading dock and saw Kathy sitting there, alone, dangling her feet off the edge of the dock. It was a full moon, and the light came down on her face. I don't think I'd ever seen her more beautiful than she was right then. And my heart was bursting because I really knew, that I was so in love with her that I could never tell her how much I wanted her.
What did you do?
Jane asked. I cheated, I said. Because, you know, I had just happened to memorize large chunks of Romeo and Juliet. So as I walked towards her on the loading dock, I spoke most of Act 2, Scene 2 to her. But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and so on. I knew the words before. It's just this time I actually meant them. And after I was done saying them, I went to her and I kissed her for the first time. She was 15 and I was 16, and I knew I was going to marry her and spend my life with her.
Tell me about how she died, Jane asked,
just before the skip to Khonsu space. She was making waffles on a Sunday morning, and she had a stroke while she was looking for the vanilla, I said. I was in the living room at the time. I remember her asking herself where she had put the vanilla, and then a second later I heard a crash and a thump. I ran into the kitchen, and she was lying on the floor, shaking and bleeding from where her head had connected with the edge of the counter. I called emergency services as I held her. I tried to stop the bleeding from the cut, and I told her I loved her and kept on telling her that until the paramedics arrived and pulled her away from me. Although they let me hold her hand on the ambulance ride to the hospital.
I was holding her hand when she died in the ambulance. I saw the light go out in her eyes, but I kept telling her how much I loved her until they took her away from me at the hospital.
"Why did you do that?" Jane asked.
I needed to be sure that the last thing she heard was me telling her how much I loved her, I said.
What is it like when you lose someone you love? Jane asked.
You die too, I said. And you wait around for your body to catch up.
Is that what you're doing now? Jane said. Waiting for your body to catch up, I mean.
No. Not anymore, I said. You eventually get to live again. You just live a different life, is all.
So you're on your third life now, Jane said.
I guess I am, I said.
How do you like this life? Jane asked.
I like it, I said. I like the people in it.
Out the window, the stars rearranged themselves. We were in Khonsu space. We sat there quietly, fading in with the silence of the rest of the ship. Chapter 16.
You may refer to me as ambassador, unworthy though I am of the title, the Khonsu said. I am a criminal, having disgraced myself in battle on Panshu, and therefore am made to speak to you in your tongue. For this shame I crave death and a term of just punishment before my rebirth. It is my hope that as of a result of these proceedings, I will be viewed as somewhat less unworthy, and will thus be released to death. It is why I soil myself by speaking to you.
It's nice to meet you too, I said. We stood in the center of a football field-sized dome that the Khonsu had constructed not an hour before. Of course, we humans could not be allowed to touch Khonsu ground, or be anywhere a Khonsu might again tread. Upon our arrival, automated machines created the dome in a region of Khonsu space long quarantined to serve as a receiving area for unwelcome visitors such as ourselves. After our negotiations were completed, the dome would be imploded and launched toward the nearest black hole, so that none of its atoms would ever contaminate this particular universe again. I thought that last part was overkill.
We understand you have questions you wish to ask concerning the RA, the ambassador said, and that you wish to invoke our rights to earn the honor of speaking those questions to us.
We do, I said.
15 meters behind me, 39 Special Forces soldiers stood at attention, all dressed for battle. Our information told us that the Khonsu would not consider this a meeting of equals, so there was little need for diplomatic niceties. Also, inasmuch as any of our people could be selected to fight, they needed to be prepared for battle. I was dressed up a bit, although that was my choice. If I was going to pretend to be the leader of this little delegation, then by God, I was at least going to look the part. At an equal distance behind the Khonsu were 5 other Khonsu, each holding 2 long and scary-looking knives. I didn't have to ask what they were doing there.
My great people acknowledge that you have correctly requested our rights, and that you have presented yourselves in accordance to our requirements, said the ambassador. Yet we would have still dismissed your request as unworthy had you not also brought the one who so honorably dispatched our warriors to the cycle of rebirth. Is that one you?
I am he, I said.
The Khonsu paused and seemed to consider me.
Strange that a great warrior would appear so, the ambassador said.
I feel that way too, I said.
Our information told us that once the request had been accepted, the Khonsu would honor it no matter how we comported ourselves at the negotiations, so long as we fought in the accepted fashion. So I felt comfortable being a little flip. The thinking on the matter, in fact, suggested the Khonsu preferred us that way. It helped reinforce their feelings of superiority. Whatever worked.
5 criminals have been selected to compete with your soldiers, the ambassador said. As humans lack the physical attributes of Khonsu, we have provided knives for your soldiers to use if they so choose. Our participants have them, and by providing them to one of your soldiers, we'll choose who they will fight.
I understand, I said.
Should your soldier survive, it may keep the knives as a token of its victory,
the ambassador said.
Thanks, I said. We would not wish to have them back. They would be unclean,
the ambassador said.
Got it, I said. We will answer whatever questions you have earned after the contests,
the ambassador said.
We will select opponents now.
The ambassador grunted a shriek that would have shaved pavement off a road, and the 5 Khonsu behind him stepped forward, past it and me, and towards our soldiers, knives drawn. No one flinched. That's discipline. The Khonsu didn't spend much time selecting. They went in straight lines and handed the knives to whoever was directly in front of them. To them, one of us was as good as another. Knives were handed to Corporal Mendel, whom I had lunched with, Privates Joe Goodall and Jennifer Aquinas, Sergeant Fred Hawking, and Lieutenant Jane Sagan. Wordlessly, each accepted their knives. The Khonsu retreated behind the ambassador, while the rest of our soldiers stepped back several meters from those who had been selected.
"You will begin each contest,"
the ambassador said, and then stepped back behind its fighters. Now there was nothing left but me and 2 lines of fighters 15 meters from me on either side, patiently waiting to kill each other. I stepped to the side, still between the 2 rows, and pointed to the closest soldier and Khonsu to me.
"Begin," I said.
The Khonsu unfolded its slashing arms, revealing the flattened, razor-sharp blades of modified carapace and freeing again the smaller, almost human secondary arms and hands. It pierced the dome with a screech and stepped forward. Corporal Mendel dropped one of his knives, took the other in his left hand, and started straight at the Khonsu. When they got within 3 meters of each other, everything became a blur. 10 seconds after it started, Corporal Mendel had a slash across the length of his ribcage that went down to the bone, and the Khonsu had a knife jammed deeply into the soft part where its head melded with its carapace. Mendel had gotten his wound as he snuggled into the Khonsu's grasp, taking the cut for a clear shot at the Khonsu's most obvious weak spot. The Khonsu twitched as Mendel tugged the blade around, slicing the creature's nerve cord with a jerk, severing the secondary nerve bundle in the head from the primary brain in the thorax, as well as several major blood vessels. It collapsed. Mendel retrieved his knife and walked back to the rest of the special forces, keeping his right arm in to hold his side together. I signaled Goodall and his Khonsu. Goodall grinned and danced out, holding his knives low with both hands, blades behind him. His Khonsu bellowed and charged, head first, slashing arms extended. Goodall returned the charge and then, at the last second, slid like a base runner on a close play. The Khonsu slashed down as Goodall slid under it, shaving the skin and ear from the left side of Goodall's head. Goodall lopped off one of the Khonsu's chitinous legs with a fast upward thrust. It cracked like a lobster claw and skidded off perpendicular to the direction of Goodall's movement. The Khonsu listed and toppled. Goodall rotated on his ass, flipped his knives up, did a backward somersault, and landed on his feet in time to catch his knives before they came down. The left side of his head was one big gray clot, but Goodall was still smiling as he lunged at his Khonsu, which was desperately trying to right itself. It flailed at Goodall with its arms, too slow, as Goodall pirouetted and drove the first knife like a spike into its dorsal carapace with a backwards thrust, then reached around and with another backward thrust did the same to the Khonsu's thoracic carapace. Goodall spun 180 degrees so that he faced towards the Khonsu, gripped both blade handles, and then violently cranked them in a rotating motion. The Khonsu jerked as the sliced contents of its body fell out in front and behind, and then collapsed for a final time. Goodall grinned all the way back to his side, dancing a jig as he went. He had clearly had fun. Private Aquinas didn't dance, and she didn't look as if she was having any fun. She and her Khonsu circled each other warily for a good 20 seconds before the Khonsu finally lunged, bringing its slashing arm up as if to hook Aquinas through her gut. Aquinas fell back and lost her balance, fumbling over backwards. The Khonsu jumped her, pinned her left arm by spearing it in the soft gap between the radius and the ulna with its left slashing arm, and brought its other slashing arm up to her neck. The Khonsu moved its hind legs, positioning itself to provide leverage for a decapitating slash, then moved its right slashing arm slightly to the left to give itself some momentum. As the Khonsu slashed to remove her head, Aquinas grunted mightily and heaved her body in the direction of the cut. Her left arm and hand shredded as soft tissues and sinews gave way to the force of her push. And then the Khonsu rolled as she added her momentum to its. Inside the grip of the Khonsu, Aquinas rotated and proceeded to stab hard through the Khonsu's carapace with her right hand and blade. The Khonsu tried to push her away. Aquinas wrapped her legs around the creature's midsection and hung on. The Khonsu got in a few stabs at Aquinas's back before it died, but the slashing arms weren't very effective close in to the Khonsu's own body. Aquinas dragged herself off the Khonsu's body and made it halfway towards the other soldiers before she collapsed and had to be carried away. I now understood why I had been exempted from fighting. It wasn't just a matter of speed and strength, although clearly the Special Forces soldiers outpaced me in both. They employed strategies that came from a different understanding of what was an acceptable loss. A normal soldier would not sacrifice a limb like Aquinas just had. 7 decades of the knowledge that limbs were irreplaceable and that the loss of one could lead to death worked against it. This wasn't a problem with Special Forces soldiers who never could not have a limb grown back, and who knew their body's tolerance for damage was so much higher than a normal soldier could appreciate. It's not as if Special Forces soldiers didn't have fear. It just kicked in at a far later time. I signaled Sergeant Hawking and his Khonsu to begin. For once, a Khonsu did not open its slashing arms. This one merely walked forward to the center of the dome and awaited its opponent. Hawking, meanwhile, hunched low and moved forward carefully, a foot at a time, judging the right moment to strike. Forward, stop. Sidestep, stop. Forward, stop. And forward again. It was one of those cautious, well-considered, tiny forward steps that the Khonsu lashed out like an exploding bug and impaled Hawking with both slashing arms, hefting him and hurling him into the air. On the downside of his arc, the Khonsu slashed viciously into him, severing his head and cutting him through the midsection. The torso and legs went in separate directions. The head dropped directly in front of the Khonsu. The Khonsu considered it for a moment, then spiked it at the tip of its slashing arm and flung it hard in the direction of the humans. It bounced wetly as it struck the ground and then twirled over their heads, spraying brains and smart blood as it went. During the previous 4 bouts, Jane had been standing impatiently at the line, flipping her knives in a sort of nervous twitch. Now she stepped forward, ready to begin, as did her opponent, the final Khonsu. I signaled for the two to start. The Khonsu took an aggressive step forward, flung its slashing arms wide, and screamed a battle cry that seemed loud enough to shatter the dome and suck us all into space, opening its mandibles extra wide to do so. 30 yards away, Jane blinked and then flung one of her knives full force into the open jaw, putting enough force into the throw that the blade went all the way through the back of the Khonsu's head, the hilt jamming into the far side of the skull carapace. Its dome-shattering battle cry was suddenly and unexpectedly replaced by the sound of a big, fat bug choking on blood and a skewer of metal. The thing reached in to dislodge the knife, but died before it finished the motion, toppling forward and expiring with a final wet swallow. I walked over to Jane.
"I don't think you were supposed to use the knives that way," I said.
She shrugged and flipped her remaining knife in her hands.
"No one ever said I couldn't," she said.
The Khonsu ambassador glided forward to me, sidestepping the fallen Khonsu.
"You have won the right to 4 questions," it said. "You may ask them now."
4 questions were more than we had expected. We had hoped for 3 and planned for 2. We had expected the Khonsu to be more of a challenge. Not that 1 dead soldier and several lopped-off body parts constituted a total victory by any means. Still, you take what you can get. 4 questions would be just fine.
"Did the Khonsu provide the array with the technology to detect skip drives?" I asked.
"Yes,"
the ambassador said, without elaborating further. Which was fine. We didn't expect the Khonsu to tell us any more than they had obligated themselves to. But the ambassador's answer gave us information on a number of other questions. Since the array received the technology from the Khonsu, it was highly unlikely that they knew how it worked on a fundamental level. We didn't have to worry about them expanding their use of it or trading the technology to other races.
"How many skip drive detection units do the array have?"
We had originally thought to ask how many of these the Khonsu provided the array, but on the off chance they made more, we figured it'd be best to be general.
"1,
said the ambassador.
"How many other races that humans know of have the ability to detect skip drives?"
Our 3rd major question. We assumed that the Khonsu knew of more races than we did, so asking a more general question of how many races had the technology would be of no use to us. Likewise, asking them who else they had given the technology to, since some other race could have come up with the technology on its own. Not every piece of tech in the universe is a hand-me-down from some more advanced race. Occasionally, people think these things up on their own.
"None,"
the ambassador said. Another lucky break for us. If nothing else, it gave us some time to figure out how to get around it.
"You still have 1 more question," Jane said, and pointed me back in the direction of the ambassador, who stood waiting for my last query.
So I figured, what the hell?
"The Khonsu can wipe out most of the races in this area of space," I said. "Why don't you?"
"Because we love you,"
the ambassador said.
Excuse me? I said.
Technically, this could have qualified as a 5th question, one the Khonsu was not required to answer. But it did anyway.
"We cherish all life which has the potential for Unkat."
That last part was pronounced like a fender scraping a brick wall.
"Which is participation in the great cycle of rebirth," the ambassador said. "We tend to you, to all you lesser races, consecrating your planets so that all who dwell there may be reborn into the cycle. We sense our duty to participate in your growth. The RA believe we provided them with the technology you question after because they offered up one of their planets to us. But that is not so. We saw the chance to move both of your races closer to perfection, and joyfully we have done so."
The ambassador opened its slashing arms, and we saw its secondary arms, hands open, almost imploring.
"The time in which your people will be worthy to join us will be that much closer now. Today you are unclean and must be reviled even as you are loved. But content yourself in the knowledge that deliverance will one day be at hand. I myself go now to my death. Unclean in that I have spoken to you in your tongue, but assured again a place in the cycle because I have moved your people towards their place in the great wheel.
I despise you and I love you, you who are my damnation and salvation both. Leave now, so that we may destroy this place and celebrate your progression. Go!
I don't like it, Lieutenant Tagore said at our next briefing, after the others and I recounted our experiences. I don't like it at all. The Khonsu gave the RA that technology specifically so they could fuck with us. That damn bug said so itself. They've got us dancing like puppets on strings. They could be telling the RA right now that we're on our way.
That would be redundant, Captain Jung said. Considering the skip drive detection technology,
you know what I mean, Tagore shot back. The Khonsu aren't going to do us any favors, since they clearly want us and the RA to fight in order to progress to another cosmic level, whatever the fuck that means.
The Khonsu weren't going to do us any favors anyway, so enough about them, Major Crick said. We may be moving according to their plans, but remember that their plans happen to coincide with our own up to a point. And I don't think the Khonsu give a shit whether we or the RA come out on top. So let's concentrate.